History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as some of us are willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions and then invest the time and patience to listen as memories from long ago take on new life in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired when we gain a deeper understanding of what so many of our men and women in uniform have truly contributed and all that they've endured. I'm pretty sure that most of us can think of people in our lives who served in our armed forces, and we really wish they would have shared a little more about their time in uniform. If some of those people are still alive, then it's not too late to ask some of those questions, and maybe today's program will be the impetus for you to do just that. I don't know if there's anything I've seen in the two decades I've been interviewing veterans that's been more effective at encouraging them to open up about those military memories than the magic that's happening throughout our country thanks to the Honor Flight Network. You've heard me talk about it on this program before, and you've heard quite a few veterans from all different corners of America tell you just how much that Honor Flight experience meant to them. But I bring it up today because it's that time of year where the weather in Washington, D.C. is reaching its spring best, and Honor Flights are about to take off in many of the areas where this program airs on the radio. Why don't you grab a pen and paper, because I'm going to give you a few dates to write down in a moment. I guess some of you tech-savvy listeners can just type it into your smartphone, but if you're a longtime Hometown Heroes listener, you might remember Honor Flight founder Earl Morse joining the show over 15 years ago to talk about an effort that back then was pretty new. It started when he used his plane to fly one of his VA patients in Ohio to see the then brand new National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. That one man making a visit possible for one veteran has led to a network of nonprofits throughout the country providing that same privilege free of charge to thousands and thousands of World War II vets, paving the way for that opportunity to then be extended to veterans of the Korean War, the Cold War, and the Vietnam War. You can go to honorflight.org to learn more about the Honor Flight Network and the individual hubs. And today we're going to meet two men who are about to go on their long-awaited honor flight to their memorials. Those of you listening on KONA in the Tri-Cities or KSBN in Spokane today probably know that Inland Northwest Honor Flight just took another flight full of veterans this past week out of Spokane and is accepting applications for future flights. For those of you listening on WRFH in Hillsdale, Michigan today, Talon's Out Honor Flight will leave Kalamazoo on May 13th with its next mission. If you're joining us on KIVA in Albuquerque, the next flight for Honor Flight Northern New Mexico will be June 20th to 22nd. Honor Flight Bay Area, for those of you with us in the Monterey Salinas area on KION today, they're going to take off again on May 11th, but April might be the busiest month for Honor Flights because of that beautiful spring weather back east. And I'm sharing this today so you can get engaged. If you've never been to an Honor Flight welcome home, I hope you'll take note of these dates and make it a point to do just that. Who knows? Maybe you'll want to join a team of volunteers in your area. So just a few more for you. For those of you with us on our longtime affiliate, KYKN in Salem, Oregon, April 27th is when the next South Willamette Valley Honor Flight will take off. For those of you finding us on KVEC in San Luis Obispo or KSMA Santa Maria, Honor Flight Central Coast, California will have its first ever charter flight April 24th, so the 26th, a Wednesday night, will be the day you can welcome those 80 veterans home. Honor Flight Kern County has 100 veterans coming home to Bakersfield on Thursday, April 20th at 5:30 p.m., and I know we have a lot of you listening on KNZR there right now, so get out there this next Thursday at the Meadows Field Airport in Bakersfield. And some of you might live where you can join that welcoming party and the one the night before that I'll have the privilege of presiding over. I hope all of you KFIV, KYNO, and KMJ listeners throughout the Central San Joaquin Valley can be with us Wednesday night, April 19th, at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport for the return of the 24th Central Valley Honor Flight, when 68 veterans from 21 different hometowns and 6 different counties will be coming back from their sentimental journey. That group includes World War II veterans like 98-year-old George Medeiros of Gustine, who saw combat in Italy, and Bob McAvoy of Clovis, who went all through the South Pacific aboard three different ships, experiencing just about every battle from Guadalcanal to Okinawa. Most of the veterans going on this flight served in the Vietnam era, and we'll hear from one of them in a bit. But first, we're going to hear from a Korean War veteran named Leslie Rutherford, Rudy to his friends. I caught up with him this week at Fresno's Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor, and also home to something that happens to be very significant to Mr. Rutherford. His ship's bell. But before we find out how that artifact ended up in the museum, let's go back to the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Fresno, California. I've lived in Fresno, California all my life, except for the 4 years I was volunteering in the Navy.
That means you must have lived through World War II here as well. Yeah, what do you remember about those years and what this area was like then?
Oh, I was here in World War II, and, well, like I say, all my life. I was raised around Layton, which is a little town. My dad was a farmer. He drove horses and worked in the vineyards and stuff like that. So we traveled different places in Fresno County.
So you would have been 9 years old or so when Pearl Harbor happened. Do you have a memory of that?
Yes.
What do you remember?
Well, it was quite a shock to us. All I can remember is that it was an experience just for a small child to comprehend.
Did you have any friends in school or anything who were Japanese American?
Yes.
So they probably weren't around too much longer.
Not very long. They were shipped off. My dad bought a lot of furniture from them as they left, and so I knew what was going on. And most of them had farms, and they had to hire somebody to take care of their farm or sell it or whatever they had to do to get out of here. But it was quite a experience to see them take off. They publicized it quite a bit here, Fresno.
So you lived through that entire war, and this is while you're really growing up, you know, going from a boy to a man. Is there anything else from that time period, the World War II years, or how it ended?
Well, I had my mother's uncle was in World War I, and he was wounded there, and he talked about it quite a lot. And then his son was in Pearl Harbor at the time that the raid went on, and ended up with metal in the back of his head, and he came home, but he didn't last long. It was too hard for him to live. He had headaches all the time, and so he just took his own life. So
that would have been a cousin of yours?
Right. Been my wife, my mother's cousin.
So at a very young age, you're confronted with the reality of war.
Right.
And when World War II ended, I mean, I'm sure you weren't thinking, hey, there's going to be another war right around the corner.
No, had no idea.
So what were your plans when you were finishing up high school and all of that?
Well, I worked for Fresno Concrete Pipe Company and just trying to make a living.
And then the Korean War started?
Right. I figured I was going to end up going, but I didn't want to go to be a ground pounder, which I call the Marines or Army. So when I went to sign up here in Fresno for the draft, I told the people there at that time, there was a gal that I talked to, and she said, well, you're quite a ways down right now, but if something comes up a little closer, she said, I'll call you. And I said, thank you. And so she did call me, and I come up and joined the Navy. So then I went to San Diego, done my boot camp. I had a problem with my teeth, so they worked on that for about 2 months. And then I ended up going to Japan and met the ship there, USS Menard. It's an APA 201, had 26 landing craft on there, and I was the engineer on one of them. So we'd done a lot of practicing out in the water and all that, so make these landings.
And where's the bell of that ship now?
It's here in the museum.
In Fresno?
Yes.
How'd that happen?
Well, at our third reunion, the guys was asking, well, is there any part of the ship left? And they said, well, no, it's been scrapped. And we had one of the wives of the shipmates of World War II said she worked for a congressman. And so she started inquiring. He said that the ship was scrapped, but the only thing left was the ship's bell. I was the treasurer of the organization at that time. And I started working to see what we could do, but at least get and find out where it's at and all that. It was in a church in Shiraw, South Carolina, up in the bell tower.
Huh.
And we had a couple shipmates go there, and they had to climb up in the tower, and it was full of bird stuff. And they said, this is no place to bring anybody to see the bell. So one of the guys asked, well, what would you need to get that bell out of here? And in the meantime, we started writing to our congressmen and senators. I wrote a letter to each one of our shipmates that we had at that time. And they started writing, and we had one shipmate that lived in D.C. He went to the what they call the gun factory, and that's where they were dealing with the used stuff off of the ships. He said, I'd like to talk to you about the USS Menard Bell. The guy said, USS Menard Bell? He said, see that stack of letters on my desk? I have to answer those. And he said, it's getting to be a problem. So he said, I will get you another bell, and if you'll pay for shipping it to Shiraw and getting it changed. So I got on the phone and started talking to different people, and I had a shipmate that lived on the East Coast, and his daughter worked for a trucking company, and she said, well, I can get the bell transferred to Shiraw, South Carolina. So that's how it got there. In the meantime, it was in the church that had... It was a real old church, and had the cemetery in the church yard. I had narrow roads, so I had to hire a narrow gauge crane to go in there and go up in there and take the old bell down, our bell down, and put a new one up there, which cost us over $1,000. So we paid for that.
Why was that so important to you?
Well, not many of the reunions have their own bell, and that was very exciting for us.
So every time you have a reunion, the bell is there?
I checked it out and took it from here. Well, to go back to, I come in here, Chuck Mungus was the manager then, or curator. I asked him, I said, how would you like to have a ship's bell to put on floor here? And he said, where in the hell are you going to get a ship's bell? And I said, well, if you'll help me get the paperwork set up, I'll bring one back to you. The fourth reunion was in Mobile, Alabama, and a shipmate that picked up the bell took it to a bell factory and had it cleaned up, and he brought it on over to Mobile. And in the meantime, I built a little trailer that, like a ship, looks a little bit like a ship, painted like a ship with the USS Menard on it. The bell and the trailer met at one place. Everybody kissed the bell and bragged about it, and it's been to every reunion since then.
And so, it's also been in every Veterans Day parade in Fresno?
Most of them, yes.
Uh-huh.
I missed one. I took it one time to Branson for the Branson's Veterans Parade.
Uh-huh.
And then since... we had the 100th, was the last one I was in here in Fresno, and since then it's been with COVID and all. I didn't make the last one, and right now I'm working with the Vets Center, which is the ones that helped me get my 100% disabled for PTSD, and they're going to help me get it back in the parade, so we're working on getting it back this year.
So November 11th, 2023, people can see you pulling that trailer with the USS Menard Bell.
Right.
Love it. Well, before I hear about the history that you're preserving, obviously you've invested a lot of your life into preserving that bell, putting it on display.
Yes.
Having it at the reunions, having it in the parade. Why? What do you get out of that? What's the importance of that?
It's an honor to do that. And I also take it to the cemetery. Oak Grove Cemetery, which is in Layton and the surrounding area there, Memorial Day. And I ring it for the veterans that are buried that year.
So are you doing this all for those who aren't here to speak for themselves?
Right.
Thank you for doing that.
Well, it's been real gratifying.
Well, let's hear about some of why you want to keep the memory of the Menard alive. What are some of the things that you did or experienced aboard that ship?
Well, I was... an engineman, mechanic, diesel engines, and right when I got on the ship, it was mostly all reserves, and as we learned what we were supposed to be doing, the reserves would leave. So I ended up being the captain's driver and gig engineer, and I drove for Captain Finnegan and Captain King. Just before I got off of the ship, which was in January of 53, I believe it was. We had some problems aboard ship, and the CID come on there. And Ben's, I drove with the captain. They kept asking me questions, things that were going on in the, on the board there. And I wouldn't talk to him. I just wouldn't give him any information at all. But he, we spent a lot of time out on the fantail just talking.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I said, I want to get off of this and go to a different, I'd like to get on shore duty. And I said, I think I'd like to go to Alaska. I don't know why I picked Alaska, but I did. And this guy that we were talking to that was with CID, he said, well, that sounds good. So, but anyway, I got my orders, and he intervened, and I ended up in Incheon, Korea.
It's a long way from Alaska.
A long way from Alaska, and the weather is somewhat similar in the wintertime and opposite in the summertime.
But little did he know the weather would end up being the least of his concerns. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, the secret duty he was pressed into in the Korean War and the burden he carried for decades afterwards. Rudy Rutherford is among the scores of veterans visiting their memorials in Washington, D.C. this month through the Honor Flight Network. Learn more about that at honorflight.org or link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode focusing on the Honor Flight Network as the peak flying season begins with great spring weather in Washington, D.C. Earlier, I gave you a list of dates for Honor Flights in areas where Hometown Heroes airs on the radio. If you're one of our listeners from elsewhere through the magic of the internet, you can connect to an Honor Flight hub near you at honorflight.org. 91-year-old Rudy Rutherford of Fresno, California will be leaving Monday morning with Central Valley Honor Flight. And if you live around there, you can welcome him home Wednesday evening, April 19th in Fresno. But 7 decades ago, it was a much more tense situation. When we left off, this Korean War veteran had told us about how someone from the CID, Criminal Investigation Division, had discussed a change of duties for Rutherford after some less than ideal incidents aboard the attack transport USS Menard. Rutherford had mentioned Alaska as a potential destination, but ended up in Incheon, Korea instead, having no idea what kind of cloak and dagger life he'd be living for the next 13 months.
I ended up there. I was put in charge of the motor pool there, and I walked out on, we had four corners right downtown Incheon, and I walked across the street to go to the chow hall to eat, and he met me out in the middle of the street, this guy that was on the ship, and he said, do you know who I am? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, I've got a problem here in Incheon. He said, we have a group which they called the Feck Leg outfit down on the waterfront. And he said, they have no transportation, no ways of having transportation, stuff like that. They need to go out and target practice all the time. So I want you to go down and talk to one of them. He gave me their name, and I went down and talked to him, and he said, yeah, we'll work with you. So I take a couple of Jeeps and pick them up and take them out when they weren't on duty, going up the river or whatever they did.
These are basically special forces guys?
Yes.
Kind of undercover?
Undercover, uh-huh. Yes. So anyway, we take them out on approach. There was an area way out in the country that nobody was around, just rolling hills, and they would practice firing the guns and target practice. They also went up the river behind the lines and took spies up there. Well, some of them were the spies. And they had it looked like a Chinese junk or a boat that looked like what the Koreans used to go up the river with. But they had a gray marine engine in it. So they said their engineer had left. So they said, well, you need to go with us just in case something happens.
So you can fix the engine in case they get stuck.
So anyway, I started getting with that, and they told me that we had to, anybody that was on the river banks on either side, we had to do away with them and throw them in the river so they would go to sea, and we wouldn't leave any evidence knowing that we were going up there. So that's what I did. I made several trips of that. And the first time, they always told me, don't hesitate. And shoot them in the face, because that's the only place that you could get to. Between the eyeballs, they said. But the first time I hesitated a little bit, the guy shot at me, and the bullet hit my helmet. My head went sideways, and the second one went right by my ear. So if I hadn't got hit in the helmet the first shot, I wouldn't be here.
So getting hit by a bullet in the helmet saved your life?
Yes. Boy, they really chewed me out for not shooting and without hesitating. So I learned to shoot first. And we did that many times.
You mentioned to us that the VA Vet Center was helpful in getting you your 100% disability for
right.
PTSD. I don't want to make you talk about anything you're not comfortable with.
Well, but when I was there, they told me that if I talked to anybody or mentioned anything, that I would go home in a body bag.
Because you guys weren't supposed to be there.
No. And so I just tried to forget it. It was hard sometimes. The biggest problem I had was when we had people coming home, veterans coming home that were deceased, and they would get all excited, you know, and have a funeral. And that would bother me because the people that I killed had a mother and a father. Maybe he was a brother or a sister. Maybe he was married. Maybe he had kids, you know. And he wouldn't be able to go home. And that bothered me. And from 55 until about 10 years ago, I lived this. And then I was going to the vet hospital. They told me that my problem was self-inflicted. When I worked in the fields and I had a forklift business and things like that, and that was what caused my problems. I said to the gal, I said, do you know what the weather's like in Korea? It's dust in the summertime and cold in the wintertime. I had emphysema. I never smoked in my life. She said, well, you were on the ship all the time. I said, no, I wasn't. I was in Korea. And she said, during wartime? And I said, yes. She said, well, it doesn't show, you don't have any records. Well, when you work for those people, your records are out of sight. She said, well, you have to go over to the vet center now and talk to them. So I went over and got started over there. Her and the guy that was my councilman,
yeah.
He said, well, we will work around this. I said, I'm not supposed to talk about this. He said, we'll work around this. We won't use names or dates or any kind of a name
right.
or date of anything. So, and then he said, you need to talk about this. He said, you bring your wife with you every time you come here because she don't know what you did. And she learned a lot about me after we'd been married 50-some years.
So how does that work for you now? Are you free from some of those flashbacks or that burden you were carrying for so long?
Pretty much. I can talk about it now talk to my kids, my children, and family. And they all understand why that I acted the way I did during all those years.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to pry. I'm just wondering if there's anything you can share with us, because most of us have not had this experience. We don't know what it's like. Mm-hmm. We don't know what you carried with you for all those years. Is there something you would share that would maybe help us understand what it's been like for you, what this road you've had to travel has been?
Well, like I say, the biggest problem was when everybody talked about their family coming home or a veteran coming home and being deceased, that it bothered everybody. And like I say, that bothered me because of what I did to the people over there.
Yeah.
And that was a big problem. It seemed like a worse problem than anything else for me.
You were just following orders, but the reality of it weighed on your conscience. What are you hoping this trip does for you, going to see the Korean War Veterans Memorial and
sites? I've been in D.C. a couple, three times. I've seen the wall. I've seen some of the Lincoln Center from a distance and a lot of those places. But when I was there, they were just starting the Korean Memorial. So I have never seen that. I've seen it on pictures or on the TV.
What do you think you're going to be thinking about when you go there?
I'll be real sentimental.
Are there some guys that you knew well that you lost over there?
No, but see, when we were there, we were in charge of communication, evacuation, and transportation. So the skipper, when I got there, said, "Benj, you drove with the captain. You know what the situation is, so I'm going to have you as my driver for the news media and things like that." So I did that.
Drove reporters and photographers around and all that?
To the front lines, yes. They actually conned me into going one time, and then people on the other side shoot at you, and it's scary. Hear the bullets hit those metal on the side of the tanks. So a lot of times I would spend the time there. They had a cave, and right across from the street from the cave, which was a medical place, they had a mess hall. Instead of just sitting around doing nothing, I'd go over to the mess hall and help them or fill in if they needed some help. And then when an ambulance would come in, we would go and unload the ambulance. So I seen a lot of tore-up vets that come in there. Then you'd carry a litter in there, and there's a person standing at the gate, and they'd read the tag on the body and say, "Straight through to the operation room or to the left." And then they had another room they called the dead room. And a lot of those people weren't dead yet. And they'd start screaming and hollering and, you know, "I don't want to go to the dead room. I don't want to go there." So I come back and I talk to this gal. It was a lady at that time. I said, "Please don't call it the dead room. Just say the right room or something, you know." So, because that really bothered me. I was there 13 months.
Yeah.
So I seen a lot. And right at the time when they, of course, like I say, the captain wanted me to be the driver, well, they had a three-star admiral coming in for the peace talks. So I got to drive him to the peace talks three different times.
Were you driving a Jeep or what?
No, they had a Chevy four-door sedan.
Out of curiosity, what's the coldest temperature you experienced over there?
We didn't have a gauge.
Pretty cold, though, huh?
Well, the water truck, we had a tank in the middle, and you'd have to haul water around, and the spillage would freeze inside of the bed, and it stayed frozen most of the winter. So that's how cold it was.
That puts it in perspective. And the Korean War has famously been referred to as the Forgotten War.
Right.
What would you say to us about why it shouldn't be forgotten, why it still matters 70 years later?
Because we lost so many personnel.
Well, and you're going to a memorial that honors those men who died, and just knew within the last couple of years they've added a bunch of names there that you can read. Have you ever seen that satellite photo that shows North Korea at night and South Korea? That's all lit up down here and all black up above? That's because of you guys.
Well, yeah.
Well, if there's anything I didn't ask you about that you want to share, feel free, but I want to be the first of many to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. When you think back on all of that and 91 years here, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I'm not a hero. I just did what I was told to do. When I was a youngster, and my uncles coming back that was in this service, you know, they say, well, they push you to do this, do that, you know. And I got it in my mind when I joined the Navy that I had to take orders and do what they asked me to do. So I made an impression everywhere I went because I did what they asked me to do and didn't argue with them or cause problems. So most places I relieved, when I went to different places, I relieved a rate higher than what I was.
And you've been married to Dorothy for going on 68 years here?
Yes.
What do you think it's going to feel like when you get back to the airport and you see her and all those other people waiting for you at the end of this flight?
Be very emotional. That's like coming home again.
Well, we hope it's everything that you've imagined and more. Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
Well, I've had probably had, when they first started those, I had the chance to go over there. But I figured it would just be a hurry-up thing, you know, and I'm kind of a carefree, easy-going guy, and I just figured that it's going to be kind of rough on me, especially now. But we'll make it work.
You got a lot of people by your side. That unit that you were doing the secret trips up the river with and all that, is there a name for that unit?
Fake Leg.
Fake Leg? Is some of that stuff still classified, or now it's okay to talk about?
I would imagine, because you're still fighting that little fat boy.
Yeah. I just don't want to get you in any trouble. All right.
I would imagine. Like I say, I didn't say any names or places, so.
As revealing as some of the answers may be, sometimes they just leave us with more questions. Maybe someday some of that will be declassified, but one thing I can tell you for sure, 91-year-old Rudy Rutherford is one of 68 veterans that you'll have the chance to welcome home Wednesday, April 19th, if you live anywhere near Fresno, California. Again, link to more information about the Honor Flight Network at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a Marine whose assignment was a little different from what you might expect, an assignment that propelled a career and a passion that hasn't left him since, and may just come in handy on his honor flight this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode highlighting the Honor Flight Network and the upcoming flights full of veterans taking off in pretty much every area where you listen to this radio program. If you missed that rundown of upcoming flights earlier in the show, you can find it at hometownheroesradio.com. So get out to the next homecoming event where you live. I guarantee it's going to give you goosebumps. And if you happen to live in California's San Joaquin Valley, you could do that two nights in a row this week if you want. Thursday, April 20th will be the return of Honor Flight Kern County's latest mission, and you can greet those veterans at Bakersfield's Meadows Field Airport. Wednesday, April 19th, a little further north of there, Central Valley Honor Flight will return with 68 veterans whose service spans seven different decades, starting in 1941. That group will actually be visiting the National World War II Memorial the day before, April 18th, which will be the 81st anniversary of the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo, when those courageous B-25 crews took off from the USS Hornet on an unprecedented one-way mission. One of the vets on this flight witnessed the sinking of the Hornet 6 months later. If you've ever seen film of the Doolittle Raiders taking off from the Hornet, you have a palpable sense of how risky it was and how much courage it required. But we have that footage because a photographer was there to capture it. Another veteran going on this honor flight to Washington, D.C. is Fred Smith. Photography is what he ended up specializing in the Marine Corps, and what has colored so much of his life ever since. Fred, how old were you when the view through that lens started to captivate you?
Well, I think I was in junior high school. I used to play around. We had a little film camera, and I used to have fun making goofy little movie-type things with it. Really, in high school, I started photography in high school. I took 2 years at McLean and did quite well. Had a picture in the New York World's Fair.
What was it of?
There was an old pump house on Belmont Avenue heading up to the Kings River that was abandoned and it was falling apart. It had an old rag hanging over the window and it had some rusty pans out front. And I thought it was real interesting. I shot a photo of it and then I sepia-toned it brown. And I entered that and won an award with it.
In the World's Fair in New York?
Yes, it was part of a contest put in by Eastman Kodak in Senior Scholastic magazine. And then they took an exhibit to Europe, on a tour of Europe. I don't know if mine was included in that or not.
So that kind of added a little juice to this interest you had, huh?
Yeah, I loved it. I did real well in it. I loved it, developing and printing. And then I continued at Fresno State, press photography course there before I joined the Marine Corps. And I had no idea I'd be a Marine photographer. I just enlisted because I wanted to be in the Marine Corps. And I was anxious to be part of that. There was no guarantees. They asked me if I had a hobby, hobbies, and I said, yeah, photography. And they said, oh, can you develop and print? I said, sure. And I never thought anything of that until the last day of boot camp. They gave out MOSs, and I was a 4600, and nobody knew what that was. So I had to go all the way to the headquarters building to find out it was photography. So I was real excited about that.
Did you even know that the Marine Corps had photographers or videographers?
No, that never entered into my mind about it. Like I said, I went in there not having a clue what I was going to be. I know out of high school I had several jobs, restaurants. I was actually cooked at the old Carnation restaurant, and I put none of that on my history. I did not want to be a cook.
Well, and I should ask you too, when you joined the Marine Corps, like what year it was, and why? Why that was the decision that you made?
I don't know. I've always been fond of the military and growing up and watching movies, war movies and things. And I don't know. I was always very patriotic. In high school, I was into scuba diving with a friend, and we had talked about joining the Coast Guard, supposedly to learn maneuvering boats and stuff, and afterwards going into a dive boat. But they had a waiting list. I also signed up for the police cadets, and they had a waiting list. And while that was all in wait, a friend of mine had gone in the Marine Corps and told me about it. And so I decided that was what we were going to do. So I enlisted in the Marine Corps. And then after I enlisted, of course, those other things came up. But I'm glad that I chose the Marine Corps. It was a wonderful experience that I'll always be proud of.
How long were you in?
3 years, 1967 to 1970. Mm-hmm. With the 5th Marine Division at Camp Pendleton.
So had you finished college or you left college to go in?
I left college. It was my second year, so I got two partial years, you know, of college.
Because this is a time in our country's history where a lot of guys are trying to figure out how not to end up in Vietnam. And when you volunteer for the Marine Corps in 1967, there's a really good chance you're going to end up in Vietnam.
Yeah, I did, but I love my country. I wanted to be part of it. I wasn't shying away from it. Like I said, anything they would have given me, I would have taken. I had no clue going in what it was going to be.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. It just knowing a few things that you ended up with the opportunity to do, sounds like there are a whole lot of experiences you had in the Marine Corps that you probably never would have had otherwise.
Oh, absolutely. I think back if I should have made a career out of it because I really enjoyed it. But then I think of the great things that it led me to because I was a photographer in the Marine Corps and got into motion picture work that led me into television. So when I got out, I first went to work with Channel 30 with Al Radka, Gus Ernial, and Roger Rocca. And they were still black and white in news in those days. And after about 3 months, an opening came up at Channel 24 that was full color and paid more. So I moved over there and I was 15 and a half years as a news photographer and also did PM Magazine.
Met a lot of interesting people, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. News was a wonderful thing, and so many different things. You're always meeting people coming through. It got me some wonderful experiences. Like I got to fly with the Blue Angels in an F-4 Phantom, and then I was able to fly an Air Force One with Jimmy Carter when he came to view the drought problems in the valley.
I may ask you more about those two things, but I think you're still using these talents now, right? You're still active in photography or motion pictures?
Oh, yes. Photography's in my blood. I love it. In 85, I started my own video production business, and I've done that for years, doing a lot of different kind of industrial and commercial videos. Shot hundreds of weddings, both still photography and video, plays, recitals, you name it. I finally decided around 2010 I wanted to slow down and semi-retire, but I didn't give it up. I just scaled back. Concentrate mainly on plays and recitals and concerts, but I don't know. I wouldn't want to give it up. I'd miss it. I'd be bored sitting around home, you know.
Tell me some of the things you did in those 3 years in the Marine Corps. Where were some of the places they sent you, some of the things you saw, witnessed, documented?
Well, I started out as a photographer with the 5th Marine Division. We were all still photographers, and we covered everything. You did all the portraits, ID stuff. You shot all the awards in the commanding general's office, all the change of commands, everything that could be investigative stuff. We shot for local newspapers. A lot of my pictures went into San Diego newspaper. We covered the opening of San Onofre, the nuclear power plant, because that's on Marine Corps property. When we had operations, you'd go out in the field for 5 days, just on your own. You'd come in with a landing craft or fly in with the helicopters or whatever, and you'd spend all those days covering everything. You're on your own. Runners would pick up your film that would be taken in to be processed. The flip side, if you didn't go out in the field, you'd be in the lab for those 5 days processing and printing, and you'd work all day long, and it was great. I loved the lab work. Boy, a lot of fun things, deal. One of the greatest experiences I had was joining the 5th Recon Marines on a submarine trip, and we assaulted San Clemente Islands in the little rubber boats, and that was really a lot of fun. And then famous people came around that we'd shoot, would visit the base. You never knew what it was going to be day to day. There was a point, I think it was around 68, when we had an entire division going over to Vietnam. And we were covering that extensively. And a friend and I decided we would volunteer to go as a team. I would be the motion picture photographer, and he would be the still photographer. And we packed up and everything. But came to the last day, they said, nope, we don't need any photographers, so they didn't take us. I think the division primarily kept me there because I was the most experienced to train other people.
You mentioned famous people would come around. Any that stand out that made a good impression on you?
Yeah, the Rebel, Johnny Yuma, the Rebel. I don't know if you remember that TV show.
Uh-huh.
He came, he was donating a dog to one of the regiments there, and he came with his children and spent a whole day with them going around the base and trying out different weapons and visiting everything. And I have about 10 or 12 8x10 photographs of him and his children. I'd like to find his relatives to give it to them someday.
I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. How much feel did you have for what the Marines who were going over to Vietnam we're up against, we're faced with, we're dealing with?
Yeah, we followed it pretty closely, and we were on top of everything that was going on there. And of course, we had people coming back from there, so we heard pretty extensive reports on what was going on, and pretty scary.
But in your role as a photographer there at Pendleton, you're taking photos of guys about to head to combat, guys coming back from combat. What do you think we need to know about those guys who were over there fighting this war?
Well, a lot of what I shot were medal presentations and stuff. It would have been a lot of people that had returned from Vietnam. It'd be in the general's office, you know, getting medals and changes of command. So you saw a fair number of them. I didn't always get a chance to know them personally, you know.
Well, speaking of knowing guys personally, are there any names on that wall of 58,000 names that you're hoping to pay a visit to?
Yes, there are. There were some I was real close to at the division, and I'm going to look up their names and check to see if any of them appeared on there. One of my friends did go right after I left, and I guess he turned around pretty fast because he came back and was assigned as my replacement in San Francisco, and he had been wounded. Mm. And so like I said, I was there for 9 months. He came with about a month. So within about 8 months, he went to Vietnam and was wounded and healed and returned. So that's a pretty scary thought.
He was wounded as a photographer?
As a photographer, yes.
Yeah.
He asked before about how the photography led me into the future. In the middle of the, probably 68, we had a large event going on that they wanted motion picture coverage of, and at that time we did not have anyone shooting motion picture. So I got about an hour long class on how to operate this little film camera, and I went out in the field for 5 days shooting film. At the same time, there were civilians out shooting that had years of experience, and all the film was sent to headquarters Marine Corps, was processed and viewed, and then they took out what they wanted. And I apparently shot better footage than all the civilians, so I was then given to secondary MOS as a motion picture photographer. So that was primarily what I did from that point on.
Any other memories from your Marine Corps days that are kind of prominent in your mind?
Well, boot camp. I mean, no Marine's ever going to forget about boot camp. That was just an incredible... Even though you've had people tell you about it, you know, just an unbelievable experience, but very effective, because you come out of boot camp ready for anything. You don't think there's anything you can't handle. You live through that, you can live through anything.
And we've all heard that saying, once a Marine, always a Marine. What does that mean to you?
Absolutely. You know, one thing they teach you is brotherhood. When you're in boot camp, if you screw up, you don't get punished, everybody else gets punished. They'll have the whole platoon doing knuckle push-ups in the gravel, and they'll be saying, thank you, Private Smith, you know, while you're standing there watching. So you learn that if you screw up, other people die, and you're dependent on each other that way. And so there's just that tremendous comradeship that you develop, you know, and you know that we all depend upon each other.
And have you seen a carryover of that mentality that they tried to drill into you in your civilian life after your military days?
Well, if anybody, another Marine knows you're a Marine, there's a Semper Fi, hoo-yah, you know, and it's interesting. At one point, I went to a photography school in an Army base in Fort New Jersey because the Marine Corps didn't have one. And luckily, I was senior, so I got to march the doggies back and forth each day. But I saw this tremendously different world from the Marine Corps. They looked like they slept in their clothes. Their bunks were all wrinkled. Everything I had was fully starched. My towers were bloused. We were very proud of our uniforms, and it was just a different world. It wasn't there. You know, it's not that they're not good soldiers or something, but in the Marine Corps, that's forced into you. You're proud to be a Marine. You got to be perfect all the time. Your rack has to be tight. Your locker has to be perfect. Your uniform, everything, you know, and it's still in. And I have friends that I have one good friend, spent 3 years in the Marine Corps and 17 years in the Army. If you meet him today, you'll never know he was in the Army. He's a Marine inside and out. That speaks to how that works in your life.
I know you've had some time to think about this trip. Is there a part of it that you're most looking forward to? A spot that you're going to see or an element of it?
We're excited because the first thing we're going to see is going to be the Marine Corps, of course. But all of that is just, you know, the Vietnam Wall, certainly, you know, searching that out. And like I said, I've followed all the different wars, you know, through history, and there's so much I'd like to see from different ones.
So when you go to that Marine Corps War Memorial, it's that giant statue of February 1945 atop Mount Suribachi with the raising of the flag, but that monument is dedicated to all Marines.
Yes.
Since 1775, and it has some quotes on there from famous leaders through the years. But you're going to be standing in front of that monument with, I believe, six of your fellow Marines. I think there's seven Marines on this flight. For those of us who aren't Marines, can you explain what you think that moment's going to feel like?
Oh, just tremendous pride. This was an example of the Marine Corps that they always did. They were the first to go. They were the ones that would take over. Boy, I don't know. There's just no stopping them, you know. You've seen so many times throughout the year how the Marines, how successful they were on all these island deals, and in cases even in Vietnam where hills were lost and the Marine Corps go back and retake them. And there's just that pride in the Marine Corps and the gung-ho to not hold back, go at 100%, you know, get in there and fast and get it done. And like I said, coming out of boot camp, we're ready for anything. Send us go. We're anxious to go. You know, they had to hold them back. They weren't regretting, you know, being afraid of being sent. They all wanted to go, you know, and be part of it.
One thing we see on these flights with a lot of the veterans of your era, a lot of guys tell us, you know, they end up with the welcome home they never got before. I don't know if it was any different at Camp Pendleton because of the patriotism and military fervor around San Diego County, but do you remember times where it might not have been wise to be out in public in uniform?
Well, yeah. You know, during that period is when there were the radical groups and the hippies or whatever all screaming and hollering all the time and calling the returning soldiers or Marines or whatever, baby killers. And that was disgusting. And I know a lot of times when we went on Liberty on the weekends, you didn't wear your uniform. You were proud of what you were, but, you know, you didn't want to take it around to these places and be attacked or called on that. And that's same. And I think that's why a lot of people didn't really talk about their background sometimes after. There was that stigma to it, and now it's wonderful. It's just amazing to see now. I'm even embarrassed. People keep coming up to me, and they see my shirt or something and say, thank you for your service. And that's kind of shocking. I never, you know, and it's the way it should be. These people are really willing to give their lives for their country. They love their country, and they'll tackle whatever to. And then these people that are the opposite, I don't understand that. They need to go live in one of those other countries and see what it's like to appreciate America and what a wonderful place we have.
Your time at Channel 24. You told us about the Blue Angels and Air Force One. Maybe elaborate on those and any other stories you covered that stand out that kind of told you, hey, this is why I do what I get to do.
Yeah, my first 7 years, I was nights and weekends, so I covered a lot of stuff, and of course, a lot of things, fires and accidents and stuff like that. Interviewed a lot of people coming through town. It was a fun job. We just loved it in those days. We were always monitoring the police stuff and racing to get there. Of course, one of the memorable things that was the Chowchilla kidnapping. And I was working nights that day. And throughout the day, we'd been monitoring the police reports and heard about the school bus missing. And in the evening, a reporter, Pat Ogle, and I decided we'd load up our gear and head down to Chowchilla to check it out. We were still shooting film. The transition was starting to happen, but we were still shooting film. And so I took an extra sun gun light and battery belt along. And on the way, we continued to monitor the reports, and we heard they had found the bus. So we wandered off into the countryside and found where it was in a river bottom and shot film of them checking out the bus. It turns out that was the only film ever of the bus, because it was towed away after that. So we continued on to Chowchilla, and I know our competitors were talking about how they're going to be, you know, feeding the network. Well, when the networks came, they all came to us because we had the only footage in existence that you still see today. When they do the updates, you'll see a shot of the bus in there, and that's my footage. That's still there. So that's very memorable. We covered it throughout. an interesting sidelight to that was Broadcast Magazine did a full-page article in there that said ENG, the electronic news gathering, as they call it, the ENG Emperor has no clothes, because this event was only captured on a CP16 on film. So making fun of the fact that it only got it on film rather than video. But shortly that year, we transitioned into video.
Flying with the Blue Angels, what was that like?
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. They were flying out of Porterville. You know, I don't have the best inner ear thing, so when I met the pilot, I says, you know what, just fly straight out there, turn around, fly straight back, I'll shoot some film and I'll be happy. Well, he got up there and the first thing he did is he went into a barrel roll and we pulled 5 G's. And I couldn't lift my 5-pound camera off my lap, so I just shot straight up out of the canopy so you could see sky, 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 earth, earth, as you're going around. And I was like you squeezed a sponge. I was soaking wet with perspiration. And I said, that's enough. I've had enough. Let's go back. Well, then they radioed him and said that one of the planes had a mechanical problem, so this plane was going in the air show. So he had too much fuel. So you burn fuel by turning and hitting the afterburners, and that crushes you down like an accordion. So I got out of the plane. I couldn't walk. I'm stumbling all around, and I couldn't drive back. I had to lay in the seat for about 45 minutes to get my equilibrium back. But I never got sick, but it took a couple days to get rid of the sea legs after that. But wonderful experience flying an F-4 Phantom, you know, our greatest fighter at that time.
And how about Air Force One? What was that like?
Yeah, we had a really gung-ho news director at the time when the president was coming to the valley because of the drought in those years. And he put in a whole list of requests asking for in-studio interviews and all sorts of things, and they denied everything, except he asked for a photographer on the plane. And so they allow one photographer and one reporter. They call you a national pool photographer. So I flew down to L.A., got on Air Force One there, waiting because he was out around town. And by the way, it's the first time I've ever seen Secret Service relax without their sunglasses and regular people. And so finally he came and got on the plane, and we flew towards Fresno. They gave us lunch on the plane. The plane was beautiful. It's like an office. It was all walnut paneling and pictures on the walls. And while we're sitting there, I look down and here somebody walks by in their socks with their shirt sleeves rolled up. Turned out it was the president visiting with people, because the governor and other officials from the state were there. And then I went in and shot some film of his office when we got over Fresno. They were flying over the reservoirs to look down at the low water levels. So I shot some film of them around his desk looking out the window. And then we arrived in Fresno. And the best part of that was when they opened the doors, press comes off first. So I walk out with my camera on my shoulder, and there's Channel 30 100 yards away behind a fence. So God, that was a lot of fun. But yeah, it was real exciting. Got some nice memorabilia. They sent me a plaque with a picture of the plane and stuff. So I don't think I ever appreciated it as much as I did until recent years when I've seen documentaries about how rare it is for anyone to get on Air Force One, you know, and so I think I appreciate it more now than I did then.
Are there any photos that you took in your Marine Corps days that are especially meaningful to you, that you hang on to, you look at, and they stir some positive memories?
I have a huge album of photos, being a photographer, that I shot on many, many of the operations I went on to. Showing, you know, flying off the ships and landing, the troops running out, all different types of landing craft. The submarine trip, unfortunately, I was shooting motion pictures, so I didn't get any still photographs, but that's one of my best memories. That was so much fun, learning how you launch the boats off a submarine. We're a World War II sub, and they don't have a deck. They have a false decking, which is just wooden slats, and you'd put two rubber boats side by side and two behind that, and these have little short ropes to that one, and then a long rope would go all the way up around the periscope and back, and you'd get in the boats with your gear, and the submarine would submerge underneath you, and so you're paddling like crazy, you know, and they would tow you with the periscope until you got to where your release point, and then to get back on the sub, you'd get lined up with that rope across and bang metal bars in the water, and all of a sudden a periscope would pop up, snag the rope, and you get swooped around this way, and they would surface underneath you. Uh-huh. We spent a whole day doing this, practicing this, and of course, getting swept over the, you know, all the boats getting swept over the side, and you'd see a slat coming, and you'd stick your paddle and wedge it, and that was just so much fun. And then we did it at night, and we came out of the front of the sub, pitch black, and you had to get up the conning tower, and there's only this wide to the ocean with your back against it, because you want to fall in the water, and you couldn't see anything, and followed a guide rope back to your boats. And then they towed you. They towed us from 3 miles out to 1 mile in from the island. And then we cut loose, and then we paddled all the way into the island. And the thing the recons do is they map the seabed at the beaches. They take long ropes of marks and go out and measure the depth and get a diagram for the landing craft. And then we had a couple of crews. There's an Air Force base in San Clemente. They knew we were coming, but not when. But I went with a patrol, and I actually shot film of a Marine running out onto a strip, touching a jet, and running back, and we didn't get captured. So it was a lot of fun, but that's an interesting group, the Recon Marines. I don't know if people don't know about them. They go through Army Jump School, and they go through SEAL training, and they're just 100% gung-ho. They're amazing.
What was the motivation to get signed up for Honor Flight?
Well, I've heard about the Honor Flight. Well, what a wonderful experience that would be to go with all my comrades and fellow veterans and see all of that I work, and I love my country and its history, and so I just, that'd be too good to pass up, to miss out on. I wasn't sure I'd ever get selected because there's so many that did more than me, you know, but I don't know that that's a factor.
That's what they all say, by the way, even if they've got silver stars.
Well, one reason I was anxious to go too is because that's where all the photography that was winning contests in those days. You go and see pictures from Vietnam. Somebody could shoot anything in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, and I did enter a lot of photo contests, and I was very successful. I won quite a few awards. I won two first and two seconds in the All Marine Corps Championships in 69 and All Pacific Area before that. So I have won a lot of photo contests, but I was thinking, oh, go to Vietnam. I might regret that, you know.
How many cameras are you taking on this trip? And do you think you might take some photos that might be contest worthy in D.C.?
Well, I don't know about contest. Well, I mean, that's possible. I'm just taking a still camera. I didn't want to take my big video camera because what I use is big and large, and I want to carry it around and, you know, want to enjoy it myself. But I will be taking a lot of still photos. I may give a camera to my son-in-law and let him shoot too. And hopefully afterwards I'll be able to make a really nice album.
And that album will hopefully include some priceless snapshots from the welcome home that you can be a part of Wednesday, April 19th at Fresno Yosemite International Airport, or if you're listening from elsewhere, a very similar scene at an airport near you, like Bakersfield the next night, April 20th, or Kalamazoo on May 13th, or Albuquerque on June 22nd. Again, I have that list for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and you can always connect to an Honor Flight organization near you at honorflight.org. We're out of time on the radio today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.